From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. In a world where video content is ubiquitous, where we're downloading and streaming everything from congressional hearings to kitten videos, it seems a bit quaint that there's still a place where cameras are verboten. This video-free zone? Utah's courtrooms. The courts didn't allow still photography until 1979, and in 1985, attorneys argued before the Utah Supreme Court to allow court proceedings to be videotaped. 27 years later, the rules may finally change, and today on the program, we're talking about what allowing TV cameras in the courtroom would mean for witnesses on the stand, for defendants, and for the public at large. Plus, a new exhibit examines our most vital resource, water. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Smartphones, video cameras, tablets, they could all be coming soon to a courtroom near you. Last month, the Utah Judicial Council approved new draft rules that would allow video and audio recordings of court proceedings, but it's not a done deal until after a public review. Today on the program, we are discussing the implications the change could have for the public, for lawyers, for the media, and for justice. Joining me in studio is Lori Nelson. She is the president-elect of the Utah State Bar. She'll be officially sworn in on Thursday. Congratulations, Lori. She is also the Utah State Bar representative on the Utah State Judicial Council, which governs, oversees court policies, and recommended this rule change. And she's a partner with the law firm of Jones Waldo. Again, Lori Nelson joining me in studio. Lori, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Jeff Hunt. He is an attorney with Parr, Brown, Gee, and Loveless, and he specializes in media and First Amendment issues. He was on the committee that discussed the rule change with the Utah State Judicial Council, and Jeff Hunt is joining us via Skype from Sun Valley, where he will be attending the Utah State Bar Convention this week. Jeff, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And again, the proposed rule, it's titled 04-0401.01. So poetic. The Judicial Council is accepting public comment until August 14th on this rule change. And if you want to submit a comment online, we will put a link on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, Bottled, Filtered, and Splashed, we'll get an artist's view of water. But first, cameras in the courtroom. If you're a judge, how are you thinking about bringing video into the courts? If you're a lawyer or a defendant or a witness, would you feel camera shy or even emboldened by running video in the courtroom? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Jeff, I want to start with you. We'll get to many specifics as we go, but generally, what's the big deal about this? You know, put it into a bit of context for us.
Sure. Utah's in the bottom third of the states in the nation in terms of electronic media coverage of its courts. It has some of the most restrictive policies in the nation regarding audio visual coverage of the courts. And so what this rule will do is greatly expand electronic media coverage of the courts by allowing for the first time a video camera to record the video and audio of the proceedings and even stream those proceedings live or show them later in a recorded fashion. So it just greatly expands the public access to the judicial proceedings in both criminal and civil proceedings in the trial courts.
So is that why citizens should care about this, that it will just make this kind of secluded environment even more open and transparent?
Yeah, so that's why I think citizens should care about it. I mean, the courts are public bodies and integral to the proper functioning of the courts is public access, which promotes accountability of the judges and the lawyers, all the participants in the process. It promotes education of the process so that the public can find out what the courts are doing. I mean, our courts every day handle significant matters, criminal matters, domestic relations matters, big civil proceedings. There's a lot of important work that goes on in our courts every day, and I think our judges and the participants in the process do a great job and with very constrained resources. So I think that the opportunity for the public to actually see and hear what happens in the courtroom will be a great improvement over what we have now.
Mm. Lori Nelson, what's your takeaway for citizens? You know, why should the rest of us care? People who are not in the practice of law or who have to go before a judge on a regular basis on the other side. What does this mean for citizens, do you think?
Well, I agree with everything Jeff said. I'd also like to say that it's important for citizens to see how courts operate. There's a misconception out there because of all of the dramatic television programs and movies that we see that courts operate in a certain way. And I think it's important for citizens to actually get some reality about how the judiciary operates, how the judges work, how the attorneys work in the courtroom. And this rule allows for that. It allows for transparency while preserving the integrity of the judicial process. But it also, it's actually true reality television. It's not a reality program. It gives our citizens a view into how courts work.
Lori, how, as the president-elect of the bar, how are lawyers thinking about this rule change? Are they welcoming it as we in the press are? Or are they a little bit hesitant or thinking this is going to change the way that I do business in the courtroom?
Well, surprisingly, I haven't heard much at all from any practitioners. There haven't been any comments from practitioners during the comment period, and I have not heard any negative comments at all from members of the bar to this point. Now, I may hear more because our convention is coming up this week, but so far, to date, there's been nothing. And I truly think when you're working in the courtroom, you're really not distracted generally. People come and go. But you're still just doing your job, and there are very few distractions. And I don't think cameras in the courtroom will add any significant distraction to practitioners or to the participants.
Jeff, do you agree with that?
I do, for a couple of reasons. One is this issue has been studied extensively by the other states that have allowed cameras in the courtrooms. It's been studied at the federal level in a 3-year pilot program that allowed video cameras in the district courts and federal court. And the conclusion of all those studies is that the presence of the camera by itself does not negatively impact the proceedings. And what people find out is that you have a camera in there, sort of a novelty at first, but after 15 minutes, half our people forget it's even there. And it doesn't impact witnesses. It doesn't negatively impact the attorneys or the jurors. In fact, show that it just has no measurable impact. I think another reason for that is the technology has become so advanced now that the cameras, it's not those big, huge, bulky cameras that you had back in the 70s and 80s when cameras started going in the courtrooms. They're very small. They're very silent. There's pool coverage, so you just have one camera in there. It's put in the back of the courtroom in a very unobtrusive location, and the judge controls everything. And if the judge sees something that's a distraction, the judge has the power under the proposed rule to correct that or even to terminate coverage. So I think all those concerns have been addressed through technology and the power of the judge to control the proceedings in the courtroom.
Speaking with Jeff Hunt, he's an attorney at Parr Brown Gee and Loveless. He specializes in media and First Amendment issues. He was on the committee that discussed the rule change that we're talking about, cameras in the courtroom, allowing them in Utah trial courts. Also with us in studio, Lori Nelson, president-elect of the Utah State Bar. She is a also a representative on the Utah State Judicial Council. And Jeff Hunt joining us via Skype from Sun Valley. We've had some connection issues. We'll have to see how we continue to progress. But listeners, if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Lori Nelson, Jeff was talking a little bit about what the rule change would allow in the courtroom, and it kind of got a little bit broken up there. Maybe you could recap for us what exactly would this rule change do?
What it does is it allows media to bring a camera into the courtroom to have video coverage, audio coverage, and print coverage of the proceedings that happen in a courtroom while they are happening. So you can have a live stream, or you can have a recording to play later during a subsequent newscast.
A live stream. Did that give people on the council any hesitation? Live streams are live. You can't change it after the fact if something goes awry or if a witness has an outburst that doesn't meet FCC rules or whatever.
Well, what I can say is I don't think that happens very often, but what does happen is the court can control the process. And even in live streams, as I understand it, there is a delay, so you can protect against those kinds of things. But the rule provides for protections for particular individuals. So even in such as jurors or minors, so even in any context, there would be protections in place.
Why the trial court level to do this? You know, these are the places where there are high-profile murder cases, but there are also, you know, divorces and adoptions and cases where it's much more personal. Are cameras appropriate across the board? And where would the rules, you know, draw that line? Lori Nelson?
Well, most of it's pretty boring. So I don't think cameras would be in every single case. It would only be in those cases that there is significant public interest. Whatever type of case that may be, a huge piece of commercial litigation, a capital murder case, something that is significant to the public is, I think, the only cases where these cameras or any type of media would even be present or even present now.
So, Jeff, you represent lots of us reporters. I'm just wondering, would I be allowed to take my recorder into any court proceeding, or do I have to go through some sort of application process?
You, under the rule, you would need to make application to the court, but the requirements are very onerous. It's usually just 24 hours notice. It can be shorter if you show good cause, and you just make the request for the audio recording or the video recording, and then you can record the proceedings. And I agree with Lori. I think typically the vast amount of the audio video coverage will be higher profile cases. But what excites me about this rule is the potential for more process stories about the courts. For instance, just taking a day in the life of a criminal judge that's hearing a criminal calendar and just hearing what that judge does in the course of a day and what the criminal defendants appearing before that judge have done, what the disposition of their cases are. I think it presents an opportunity for a real slice of life type coverage of what happens in our courts. And that is the potential that really intrigues me with this new rule, to do those types of stories.
Now, the proposed changes come after a year-long study that looked at, you know, both sides of the issue, pros and cons of taping court proceedings, of allowing video in the courtroom. Courts have been talking about this for years and years. In my introduction, I mentioned media lawyers made their case to the Supreme Court, Utah Supreme Court, way back in 1985. So was there some reason why this is back in the spotlight? Jeff, I guess my question is, why now?
Well, I mean, I think it's been sort of on the back burner for the media in town for a number of years. I think this is something that the broadcast media, particularly have been wanting and have been working for. But frankly, I think the O.J. Simpson trial really kind of set things back. I think that there was a backlash and a concern among the judiciary with that case. I think a lot of it was misplaced. I don't think it was the camera in the courtroom by itself that caused that circus. I think it was a real breakdown in the control of the proceedings by the trial judge, in combination with some lawyers that were very flamboyant in their presentations and had press conferences after every day of trial. So, but I think the perception was that a lot of it was the camera. And so I think that really set things back in terms of a timetable in Utah and a lot of other states that hadn't taken that step. And I think as more time has gone on and people have sort of processed what really happened there and then done all the studies in the trial, in the pilot projects in the various states, they've learned that you really just have to build in enough flexibility and discretion for the trial judge to control the courtroom, including the camera. And if you have those checks in place, then you can have public access and transparency while still controlling and protecting the decorum of the proceedings, the privacy interests of the witnesses and victims, and the fair trial rights of the accused. And I think enough time went by that people could look at it a little more clear-eyed and determine that it was really time for Utah to join the rest of the nation and open up its courts a bit more.
Lori, is that the thinking that you understand as well? I mean, that cameras will no longer trivialize the court proceedings, but it will offer a glimpse into the justice system that we haven't had before on a widespread basis here in the public sphere.
In a widespread and realistic basis, yes.
Speaking with Lori Nelson, president-elect of the Utah State Bar, and she represents the bar on the Utah State Judicial Council, which is proposing a rule change allowing cameras in the courtroom. Also with us, Jeff Hunt, attorney with Parr, Brown, Gee, and Lovelace, who specializes in media and First Amendment issues. And we're talking about this proposed rule change. It is called 04-0401.01. So lyrical. The Judicial Council is accepting public comment until August 14th. And if you want to submit a comment online, we'll have a link on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us this morning, what effect, if any, do you think TV cameras would have on court proceedings? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a brief break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Utah is one of just 15 states that doesn't permit court proceedings to be videotaped, but that could all change very soon. A proposed rule would usher the courts into the video age. And today on the program, we're talking about what cameras in the courtroom would mean for the public, for attorneys, for judges, and of course, for justice. Joining me in studio, Lori Nelson, president-elect of the Utah State Bar, also a partner with the law firm of Jones Waldo. Jeff Hunt is an attorney with Parr, Brown, Gee, and Lovelace, joining us via Skype from Sun Valley, where he will be attending the Utah State Bar Convention later this week. And we invite you to join us as well. If you've been involved in a case, or if you're a lawyer or a judge, how do you think cameras would affect behaviors in or attitudes toward the justice system? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go to the phones, and Heidi is joining us from Salt Lake City. Heidi, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, say that I am for the cameras in the courtroom, anything to add transparency to the process. But my concern are twofold. One is that the person that is standing beside or sitting by their attorney in the courtroom doesn't really have the ability to converse with the judge directly. You can only speak when spoken to, kind of thing, and if and when you don't see eye to eye with your attorney, you're kind of muffled. Your voice is muffled. And then the second thing is the majority of what transpires in the courtroom has already been decided behind closed doors, and so again, the person is not privy to that kind of deliberation and what is being said and decided without their outside their presence.
Heidi, a couple interesting points. Thanks so much for the call. Lori Nelson, let's tackle the first one first, the attorney-client relationship. Would cameras affect that in any way?
Well, according to the rule, no. In fact, the rule specifically prohibits recording, audio, video, anything of the attorney-client communications while at the table. So the client confidential communications are protected in that regard. Also protected are attorney-judge bench conferences regarding rules. So I think the clients are protected in that regard. As to the dispute between the attorney and the client, that's something that, camera or no camera, the rule doesn't address or would resolve.
Okay. Your thoughts, Jeff Hunt?
On the bit about what happens behind closed doors, if you think about it, all the information gathering phase of a court proceeding is all done in public. The witnesses testify in public. The defendant, if the defendant takes a stand, testifies. The parties testify in public. So I think that's the most important part, is that the public be able to observe the process, how the judge rules on objections, how the attorneys present the case, all the witnesses testify. And then it's true, the jury deliberates privately, but you need to have that part of the process done in confidence. It wouldn't work to have a camera in the jury room because of the way it would disrupt the jury proceedings. But to me, the most important thing is that there be public observation or the opportunity to observe all the factual development and the information gathering that the jurors hear, and all that is done in public. And now, for the first time, the public will be able to hear and see that entire process through live video and audio streaming or through recorded presentations later.
And I guess to Heidi's point, I mean, there is a learning curve here. Not all of us know how the courts work, except for, maybe watching L.A. Law. So by watching a court proceeding live or taped, we may get a better sense of just how our justice system works, right?
I think so. That to me is the great potential of this new rule, is to put the public in the courtroom for the first time. I mean, if you think about it now, all the coverage is filtered. It's either filtered through the eyes and ears of a reporter who produces a story and it's printed, or through a broadcast story or a radio story. So now, for the first time, you don't have to have that filter. The public can hear and see what actually transpires in the courtroom, just as if they were in the courtroom themselves. And I think the potential to hear what the lawyers see and hear what the lawyers do, see and hear what the judge does, the witnesses, I think it's just going to be fantastic in terms of the potential to educate the public and to learn the work of what our courts do day in and day out.
Jeff Hunt is an attorney with Parr, Brown, Gee & Loveless, a specialist in media and First Amendment issues. Also with us, Lori Nelson, president-elect of the Utah State Bar and a partner with the law firm of Jones Waldo. And she is on the Utah State Judicial Council as well. We're talking about a proposed rule change allowing cameras in the courtroom. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Heidi, thanks so much for that call. Let's go now to Henry, who's joining us in Salt Lake City. Henry, hi.
Hello. An idea was brought up early, and I'm wondering if the guests could elaborate on more. The idea of protecting witnesses. With cameras in the room, what more will be done to protect the privacy of the witnesses and protect the privacy of individuals who might be sued? It seems like this would open the doors for a lot more for harassment lawsuits where someone could effectively say, look, I'm going to sue you, and everything will come public, and it'll be on the camera. Thank you.
It's an interesting question. What do you think, Jeff Hunt? Privacy issues, how can you protect people who are willing to go on the stand, which is already a nerve-wracking experience, I would imagine, and then be broadcast? You know, how does that work? How do you protect the privacy of those witnesses?
Well, I think it's important to point out right now, those witnesses testify in public. When you go to court, the public is allowed in the courtroom and can hear and observe those witnesses testify right now.
But you have to admit, though, I mean, the courtroom will hold, what, 50, 100 people? A TV outlet will be broadcast to thousands.
That's true, but the words of that witness can be disseminated through the newspaper. So there's going to be already the potential right now to disseminate the content. But if there is a particular concern with a privacy interest of a particular witness, say a minor, for instance, the judge can terminate the audio-video coverage of that particular witness. So the rule has the flexibility built into it, so the judge can limit this type of coverage of particular victims, sexual assault victims, for instance, or particular witnesses. So that is built into it. And with respect to the harassment issue, I think that needs to focus on the conduct. If there's improper conduct directed at a witness, harassment or any other type of improper, unlawful conduct, and that needs to be investigated and prosecuted, I think that's how you deal with that.
Lori Nelson, still at the discretion of the judge, though. I mean, the judge is the final decision maker. The buck stops with him or her. So there's no guarantee that cameras will be allowed in every case.
No, that's true. And in some circumstances, they will not be allowed and they would not be appropriate. And the judge has to protect the integrity of the process all the time. If you have a significant case involving a minor victim, if you have a case possibly involving gang or gang members where there could be retaliation to witnesses, the judge has to be able to protect the integrity of the process. And I don't believe our courts are going to be overprotective in this arena. They welcome the change. They're in favor of the change, but they are going to do what they have to do to make sure what happens is a fair and impartial process.
Henry, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Talking about a proposed change in the rules the courts have to obey. It would allow cameras in the courtroom. What do you think? Is this a good idea? 801-355-TALK is our number. David from Sandy called, could not stay on the line. Thinks this is outrageous and that getting at the truth is a very sensitive, difficult thing to do. His remarks also included that camera angles can change what people see. Was that a point of discussion, Jeff Hunt, in the deliberations? You know, exactly how you are going to position cameras to portray the truth instead of maybe something slightly different?
Well, we didn't have much discussion about the camera angles relating to that, just that we thought it was important that the judge be able to control the position of the camera to minimize any disruption and make it as unobtrusive as possible. We need to consider that the courtroom layouts vary considerably throughout the state. I mean, you can be down in a courtroom down in San Pete County and have a very different physical layout than you do in Third District Court in Salt Lake. So we wanted to make sure that the judge had the discretion and the power to position that camera. But once it's positioned, it will be the operator of the camera who will be determining what the angle is going to be. And I don't think we want to get judges involved in the business of editing or determining what video shots should be taken by the media. I don't think that would be appropriate. So that was the extent of our discussion on that point.
Lori Nelson, there, in addition to the rule that would allow TV cameras in the courtroom, there's also been discussion about smartphones, about just, you know, John Q. Public coming into the courtroom with their personal electronics. What are the proposed rules say about that?
It's similar that they will be allowed, but the judge will be able to control the process. For instance, one of the worries is you have a case where you have invoked the exclusionary rule, which is a rule that says witnesses who have not testified will be excluded from the courtroom until after they testify. You don't want someone sitting in the courtroom texting the testimony to a subsequent witness because you want to protect the integrity of the process. So again, the judge has the ability to ensure that those types of actions aren't occurring and can prohibit smartphones and other recording devices that the public brings in, but in general, they will be allowed, as I understand the rule.
How in the world can a judge monitor that from the bench? I guess relying a lot on the bailiffs, or how does that work?
I would imagine, Jeff, that's what they considered in discussing the rule. Is that correct?
Yes, the bailiffs will be responsible for monitoring conduct in the courtroom, just like they are now. So this will give them an additional thing that they'll have to watch out for. But again, the presumption is that people will obey the rules, and those that don't will be dealt with and will be, you know, have their devices confiscated or ejected from the courtroom. Mm.
Is there any cost attached to all of this? I mean, is there a price tag to allowing TV cameras? I would imagine the TV camera, the broadcast outlet will provide the equipment. But, I mean, are there other hidden costs that this rule would incur? Jeff Hunt?
No, there aren't going to be any additional costs for the taxpayers. The rule is clear that if there needs to be any additional wiring or any special arrangements made, that's all borne by the news media. They have to pay for that cost and not the taxpayers. Mm.
Is this a grand experiment, Lori Nelson? Is there a trial period, or if the rule is approved, that's the way it is?
That's the way it is. If the rule is approved, it will become a rule, of a court rule. What I think in terms of it being a grand experiment, I think this will be successful. And the reason why is because the rule was created and put together by all of the stakeholders. This was a rule that was vetted for more than a year, that had a lot of discussion that went into it. There were a number of people around the table from various perspectives to discuss this rule and create a rule that managed to address everyone's concerns and still provide the transparency that's valuable to the public.
Hmm. And just to clarify, Jeff, this will be live streaming available, or is it sort of canned tape, you know, canned videotape?
Both. The rule authorizes live video and audio streaming, as well as recording material for later broadcasts. And one important point that we haven't brought out is the definition of a news reporter, the people who are authorized to bring the camera in, is quite a broad definition, and intentionally so. It's not limited to just the major traditional mainstream news media. The definition includes anybody who gathers information for the primary purpose of disseminating it to the public. That's who has the ability under this rule to make application to the judge to do the audio-video coverage. So that definition could include citizen journalists, bloggers, non-traditional media types who disseminate information via the internet or other means. So that's kind of an exciting possibility as well for people to go in there and obtain information about court proceedings for their own communities and broadcast that to their own particular communities, justice courts and other types of court proceedings that'll really expand the reach of the courtroom in those communities.
So the public comment period goes into August. Where do we go from here? What's the next step, Jeff Hunt?
As I understand it, and Lori probably knows this process better than I do, that there'll be a public comment period, I believe, ends at the end of August or so, and then it'll go back to the Judicial Council, which will consider all the comments, and then they'll take a vote on whether to approve the rule at that point.
just a few minutes left, but I'd like to get thoughts from both of you. Does this result in more faith in the system, or does it make people even more jaded about our judicial system? I mean, it's a branch of government that, as you say, I mean, many people have not had direct contact with. So, I mean, what's the end result? Jeff Hunt first.
I think the answer is both. I mean, it'll show the system warts and all, and it'll show what is great about the system, how it works, and it'll also show if it's not working. And I think that's the way it should be. It allows another window into the working of the system. And my own feeling is that the system works remarkably well, given the constraints on the resources that the courts have to operate under. And I think that people do a pretty amazing job day in and day out in our court system. It's not perfect, and the public will be able to see when it's not operating properly, but that's good, because then they can take corrective action and bring pressures to bear to fix the problems that are perceived. So I think it's just going to be has great potential for the public to observe a branch of government that really is kind of wrapped in mystery and doesn't get the attention that the other branches typically get.
Lori Nelson, final thoughts?
I agree with that. Hopefully this will allow the public to eliminate any misunderstandings or misconceptions they have about how courts actually work, give them some insight into the process. I agree with Jeff. Members of our bench work extraordinarily hard. The staff works extraordinarily hard. And this will give the public some insight into really the value they are getting from their judiciary, which is tremendous and unseen.
Well, lawyers, you better get your game face on. Lori Nelson, president-elect of the Utah State Bar and a representative on the Utah State Judicial Council. Lori, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
And Jeff Hunt, attorney with Parr, Brown, Gee, and Lovelace, part of the committee that discussed the cameras in the courtroom rule change, and joining us via Skype from Sun Valley. Jeff, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And again, the proposed rule is titled 04-0401.01. And the Judicial Council is accepting public comment until August 14th. If you want to submit a comment online, we will have a link on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, H2O, as seen through the lens. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Life as we know it simply could not exist without water. And the photographer Paul Blackmore underscores the preciousness of water to not only our bodies, but our spirits and our cultures as well, through his many beautiful images. Today on the program, we're talking about a new exhibit of Blackmore's work, and we're exploring the necessity and the symbolism of water in our region and throughout the world. Joining me in studio is Katie Smith. She's Director of Development for the Leonardo. And Katie Smith, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning, Jennifer. It's great to be here.
The exhibit Water, Nature's Driving Force is running now through January 13th, 2013 at the Leonardo, 209 East 5th South here in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you've got questions or comments about Paul Blackmore's work with water, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Katie, you know, visitors, when you go to see this exhibit at the Leonardo, visitors are greeted with this astounding fact, 370 quintillion gallons of water on this planet. It's astounding.
It is. I don't even know how many zeros that is.
There were not enough zeros to put on the poster. Why is the Leonardo tackling such a vital resource?
Well, one thing about the Leonardo is we like to stay on top of really current issues and topics, especially as they affect multiple parts of our lives. And water was a perfect example of that, not just because it's something that we need to survive and thrive as human beings, but also because of the spiritual and recreational impacts that it has on all of our lives.
How does this exhibit approach it? You're looking at very different ways that we interact with water, how it affects our bodies, our spirits, our minds. Talk about some of those various ways.
Yeah, I think that with any exhibit that you have in a museum, you're trying to tell a story. You're taking the visitor on and guiding them through an experience. And when we looked at all of the beautiful photography that Paul Blackmore provided us with, we realized that the images really fell into some different categories. Spiritual uses of water and the impacts it has on us, recreational and fun uses of water that we all do in our daily lives, and then really some of the more hard-hitting issues related to water, scarcity of water or polluted water. And so that's actually the way that the exhibit is designed, to take you through all those different topic areas and culminate in kind of a local perspective of what water is in Salt Lake Valley, Utah.
We'll get to some of the extension activities that you've got planned surrounding this exhibit, but let's first address the beautiful images by this photojournalist, Paul Blackmore. Tell us more about Paul Blackmore. Who is he?
Paul Blackmore comes to us from Australia, and he has been working on this exhibit for a very long time. Really started with a visit he had in France, and he was looking at the theme for his next real big project and started realizing that water was going to be not just something that we turn on the tap and we always had, but really one of those issues that could drive real conflicts in the future. And something so, as you said, precious, and a word that he uses a lot, and vital, but also could create so much strife, was really intriguing to him. And so what he did was spent multiple years going throughout the world and snapping photographs, these really beautiful artistic pictures of how people interact with water in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm. These are black and white images, many taken from his book titled At Water's Edge. But I understand that you brought Blackmore to Utah to add a few more local images of the water that we love, Donut Falls and Mystic Hot Springs and Lake Powell and, of course, the Great Salt Lake. How did he approach, this project? You know, what was he looking for here in Utah?
I think he was looking for, we live in a high desert state, and water is so integral to all the places he's been. I think he was surprised, though. I think he was surprised at the beauty of the water that we have here and the different trips that he took to take the pictures. I was talking to him, and he said, I wish I had done this trip before I published my book, because there are images that I would have included. And I completely agree. I am moved by so many of the photos in this exhibit personally, and was curious to see what he would come up with from the local angle. And I have to say, some of the local pictures that he shot, like Donut Falls and City Creek, are some of my absolute favorites in the whole exhibit.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. We're speaking with Katie Smith, Director of Development at the Leonardo. July is Water Month at the Leo, and the new exhibit is titled Water, Nature's Driving Force. It's on display now through next January at the Leo. And there's more information, links on our website, kcpw.org. If you've got questions or comments about water, the role that it plays in your life, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. As you mentioned, you've divided the images into several categories. One was the spiritual use of water, and that actually didn't come top of mind for me. It wasn't my first instinct when I heard that you had an exhibit about water, but the images are really quite beautiful. He has one photograph of a young Russian Orthodox man, and he's emerging from this very cold pool. It looks like it has ice crystals on the edge. It's shaped in the shape of a cross for the ritual of Epiphany. He's got bathers from the Ganges in India. How has water really become so central to many belief systems and faiths?
I think that's one of the really unique parts about this exhibit, is that the gallery is quite quiet, and it gives you a real time for introspection and to kind of make those links across those cultures and realize how important this source is. And I know for the staff at the Leonardo, as we were developing this and looking at the images, all of these water, we call them water secrets, started coming out about how we connected individually with water and some of our memories. And then it wasn't a far leap to talk about how water is incorporated into religious rituals that are very prominent here in this valley. And then to take that leap and see how other religions or other individuals just looking for a spiritual experience utilize this in their traditions. And I find these to be some of the most moving pictures as well. There's a really beautiful image of, and I'm not even sure if it's a man or a woman, under the falls of Sot Do.
Yes.
And that, for some reason, really speaks to me personally. I love that image. And there's something that's really solitary about it, but just really cleansing at the same time, really powerful. And I think that most people who come through this exhibit will find at least one, if not more, images that really speak to them personally.
There are also some very stark images, and one in the grouping that you have talks about water as you know, a necessity of life. We cannot live without it. There's one that's a steel ship, and it's buried in a dry lake bed in Russia. And I guess Paul Blackmore went to this site knowing that there had been some ships that had been abandoned or run aground because of the lack of water.
Yeah, it's a really startling image. It's a really powerful one. And I think that the flip side of looking at the abundance of water and how we utilize it in our spiritual lives and our recreation is the flip side of that is what happens when the water leaves or we use it all up. And the Aral Sea is a really perfect example of that and something that's hard to visualize until you see it in front of you.
There was another one in that particular area of gigantic steel pipes. This is outside of Mumbai in India, and how people, I guess the pipes would take water to the wealthy, and how the poor had to tap into those pipes and actually steal the water for their very survival.
Yeah, it really highlights the socioeconomic impacts, I think, of, you know, water can be power, or access to water means that you have power. And these people, I believe it's, you know, when it's one of the statistics we have in the exhibit, as well as an installation, that we need at least 3 gallons of water a day to survive. And without easy access to water, much less clean water, you have to be creative in how you access it. And in this particular picture, it's showing how these shanties have sprung up around these pipes, and they'll drill into it to get the water they need until the officials come in and block it up, find them.
So a lot of dramatic images as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't talk about water without talking about some fun. There's a very playful image of some kids gathered around a fire hydrant that's going off in Brooklyn. I just love that image.
I do, too. And I think it's funny how Paul said, I didn't think that happened in real life. I thought that was just an image in the movies. I think we've all seen those images on TV in the movies. And that is one of my favorite parts of the exhibit, is how we have fun with water and what role that plays in our lives. And it's a real opportunity for visitors who are coming to the Leonardo to add to the exhibit, because they can bring photos of themselves, their families, and how they recreate in water and some of their great memories. And we have that as a live streaming pictorial
video
that's going on in the exhibit, and that will just continually be added on as we acquire more and more photos.
It did. The exhibit made me think, though. I mean, it does raise the consciousness that we live in a very dry state. I think it's the second driest state in the nation. And yet we as individuals use a tremendous amount of water. What sorts of discussions or, you know, even just consciousness, what are you trying to raise, the issues that you're trying to raise with this exhibit?
Well, I think even just raising awareness that it is a really precious resource and that we are in a dry state. And it's been interesting hearing some of the discussions around that particular piece that is coming up amongst our visitors. I think it's a very somewhat controversial topic about how we use water. And I have heard individuals say, you know, I don't use resources in one way. I'm not starting fires. I'm not, you know, using those resources, but I love my pool and I love to have a green yard, and that's how I choose to use the resources of our society, and I'm not really going to change. And there's myself, you know, you start thinking about all the different ways you use water, and it just really, for me personally, I realized I hate waste for waste's sake, and there are definitely just tweaks that I can do to help conserve this resource.
Mm-hmm. There are many water-themed activities that you're offering as a companion to the photographic exhibit. Tell us just briefly about a couple of those.
Yeah, one of the ones that I really love also involves visitor participation, where you can bring a water sample from your home, from a nearby lake or stream, And you bring it into the Leonardo, and our floor staff have cabbage water. And what happens, what's interesting about cabbage water is it kind of acts as a litmus paper. You pour it into the water, and depending on the acidity or the baseness of the water, it changes color. So we're taking these water samples in these jars, and we're creating a really beautiful mosaic from all the water that we've collected from our visitors. So that's something really fun to participate in.
That's really great. And there's many more facets to the water exhibit at the Leonardo. We'll have links on our website, kcpw.org. Again, the exhibit is Water, Nature's Driving Force, on showing now at the Leonardo through January 13th of 2013. The Leonardo, of course, is our neighbor, 209 East 5th South here in Salt Lake City on Library Square. And there's more information. You can call them at 801-531-9800. Or you can go to their website, theleonardo.org. And Katie Smith, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Tomorrow, profiling one of Utah's most colorful and enigmatic public officials, the doctor, the advocate, the senator, Martha Hughes Cannon. So join us for that tomorrow. Oh, and I need to thank our intern, Lauren Hendrickson. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.